Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody, welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Adelberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. Tēnei ka mihi ke te mana whenua o Aotearoa. And we acknowledge the local tribal authorities of New Zealand.
And g'day, I'm Emma Strutt and I'm currently coming to you from Darrumbull Country in Queensland. Before we dive into our conversation today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. And finally, if you enjoyed this poddy, please subscribe, like, share or comment on our social media and consider buying us a coffee if you'd like to help support our work. Now on with the show.
Here we are, closing out another year, the end of our fourth season. We kicked off this season with world-renowned nutrition expert Dr. Michael Greger. And whilst we had other amazing health experts on the show, our general theme for the year was on degrowth. Definitely our top five, top six most popular downloaded episodes were on the theme of degrowth. A lot has happened this year. A severe tropical cyclone, Gabrielle, that devastated parts of New Zealand's North Island earlier this year in February. And right now, Australia's fire season kicking off even earlier, more severe, and that's following their warmest winter on record. We've also had a very recent change of government here in New Zealand, which already is undoing a lot of policies that, whether they were strong or not, but regardless, policies that were there to start taking on climate change, they're undoing that, which aligns well with Australia's lack of inaction this year. So a lot happening, a lot not happening. And of course, not forgetting that as we record this today, the UN COP28 Climate Summit in Dubai starts today. So much to reflect on, but more importantly, how do we as individuals and collectively as a community react to all this and somehow look forward to 2024?
That's right. So given that it's our final episode for 2023, we thought it was only fitting to invite back one of our most popular guests ever and great friend of the show, Dr. Mike Joy. If that name is new to you, firstly, what have you been doing? Why haven't you been listening to us? But Mike is an award-winning freshwater ecologist and science communicator, currently serving as the Morgan Foundation Senior Research Fellow in Freshwater Ecology and Environmental Science at Victoria University of Wellington. So Mike, welcome back to the show. You've had a really big year this year, so we're looking forward to catching up.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, Emma and Ben. Thanks for having me back again. Yep, it's been a lot happening and quite a depressing sort of last few weeks with the new government that kind of looks like they're going to undo everything that we've been putting together for the last 20 years. So it's kind of a tough time, you know.
Well, we'll unpack that a little bit. But you yourself you've had quite a year yourself. Funding cut, almost out of a job for a bit, but back in it. But also, not all depressing, you've just won an award, the Callaghan Medal for Outstanding Contribution to Science Communication at the Royal Society New Zealand 2023 Research Honours. So significant that for the second time in your life, you had to wear a tie. This is big news.
Yeah, it was the last time I wore one was the Royal Society award that I got in 2013. So 10 years earlier, I got the Fleming Award that's given out every 3 years. And that involved a tour of New Zealand, you know, talking at the Royal Societies. There's a whole lot of them at different places around New Zealand. But yep, no, that was great, really nice, and it was a lot of fun because we were at Government House, and we were almost undone by this new government too, because the new government has to be sworn in by the Governor General Cindy Kiro, who was hosting our do. And so nobody knew when this government was going to form. And so we got, you know, it was months in the preparation. And then we got told at the last minute, well, we might have to just cut it down to 40 minutes instead of 2 hours and stick it in a side room and nobody can come along kind of thing, because we just don't know when this government's going to form. And, you know, the Governor General will have to stop what she's doing. But luckily they didn't decide at time and we managed to get our full ceremony. So it was a lot of fun. It was nice.
So we've got a few audience questions to run through later in the show today regarding how to be an effective climate advocate in 2024. But before we do that, let's just maybe take a look back on the year that was and talk to some projections in regards to the climate science. Of course, we'll be touching on degrowth as well and the current state of fresh water in New Zealand, because we always know that's an ongoing concern. But if you were to sit here and write up our report card for the year that's been, how do you think our corner of the world would have gone in terms of climate action? Do we get an F?
Yeah, we get an F. Well, we get an A for deluding ourselves. That seems to be the big business. Offsetting. I've just written an article in The Conversation about, just the self-delusion of believing that we can mitigate fossil carbon in the current carbon cycle, that the whole idea that we can plant our way out of this problem, it's just an incredible delusion that we... become aware of a couple of things, because also in the freshwater space, we delude ourselves with this thing called nitrogen toxicity that the government invented, that's a non-existent problem that enables more nitrogen to be released into waterways. Shocked, but I talk to people in the industry and scientists and experts and people in the policy area, and they go, oh yeah, we know that. You talk to the climate people and I talk about, offsetting being a complete have, and they go, yeah, we know that. And so they know it, and yet they go to work every day and report on it and work on it like it's a real thing. And so it's really concerning that, people in the know it. I think obviously, given the result of the election, the voting public have no idea. We kind of play these games, and I'm starting to become, I'm becoming more and more aware of the human factor, of human psychology, and how we will just, we can see with our eyes that the emperor has no clothes, but we just go along with it because that's what everyone else is doing. And it's weird. It's surreal watching it, and I don't know what the answer is to it. We don't want to change. We want to believe that we can carry on living like we do, and it's that realization that's sort of troubling to watch from the sidelines. Yeah.
So maybe let's just follow on with your conversation article, because that was really mm-hmm. fantastic. We're going to link that in the show notes. But you were talking about offsetting and the concept of net zero.
Yep.
And, they've become central to a lot of government policies regarding climate change. But if you mm-hmm. sit down and you have a proper think about the carbon cycle, or consider the logistics of the offsetting, or even take a look at some of the calculations that you mentioned in that article, the problems with this approach become glaringly obvious.
Mm.
So talk us through this. Why do you think offsetting ultimately is not going to work for us?
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's even go back one step, and people need to realize that for every tree we plant at the moment, we're chopping down two. So we're chopping down trees at twice the rate we're planting them, but somehow we're kidding ourselves that by planting trees. So here in New Zealand, we do it where we count our emissions for the year, and it's 76 million tons. This is just off the top of my head. And about 20% of that, we just say, oh, we don't have to worry about that because we've planted trees that will capture carbon equivalent to about 20% of that amount. So therefore, we talk about net emissions. So we magically wipe out 20% of our emissions by claiming that it's been taken up by trees. And trees do take up carbon. I'm not disputing that at all. And a carbon atom now, in this current cycle, is identical to a carbon atom in history, but that's where the similarity ends, because we have to understand that the current, at any given point in time, we have a carbon cycle with sources and sinks, with carbon moving through different sources and sinks through natural processes, and they're in a dynamic equilibrium. So the sources match the sinks, and any given chunk of time, that's constant. But then when we found fossil fuels, we started taking carbon from that was sequestered in carbon cycles more than 65 million years ago. So releasing them in the current carbon cycle is additional carbon. It's not part of the carbon cycle. It's not part of that equilibrium. It's a new carbon that, you know, if realistically a new carbon. And so the idea that this new carbon can be, so if we plant all the trees back again, or plant a tree, all we're doing is replacing the carbon that was lost when that tree was chopped down. Or plant a forest that, you know, all of that area was forested. So all we're doing is putting back. So a huge amount of the carbon that's been added to the atmosphere has come from land use change, from chopping down trees. And so, yes, we need to replant these trees. We do. But that's not offsetting fossil carbon. It's offsetting the carbon that was lost when we chopped those trees down. So we plant all the trees, put all the carbon back in the soil and all that. Imagine if we did that, that would be great. That would take us back to zero, to balance again. It hasn't accounted for 1 gram of that fossil carbon that we released. So that's what I mean by it. I hope people can get that. That's how delusional we are. We think that by planting a tree that captures carbon. But yes, it does, but it captures the carbon from the tree that was chopped down, not the historic stuff. And that whole emissions trading scheme is based on that same delusion, where we delude ourselves that we can offset or mitigate fossil carbon by planting trees or building renewable or whatever it is that we've, and in many cases it's just a promise not to chop down a forest that we were going to chop down. You know, so these things are so bizarre. But that would be bad enough if it was just that we were deluding ourselves and we're silly. But it's worse than that, because what happens is that we justify burning more fossils. You know, we justify the flight to London by saying, oh, we'll plant some trees, when they do not do that. So all it does is encourage us to burn more. The delusion is bad enough, but the delusion that, so I talk about dangerous trees. Trees are great. Any tree is a good thing. The dangerous tree is one that we plant under the illusion that it's going to take away the impact of the fossil carbon that we're releasing. So it's just, you know, we have to grow. I just feel like we have to grow up. What we're doing is just acting like teenagers at the moment. And we need to, somebody needs to give us a slap around the ears and tell us to grow up and face this reality and stop kidding ourselves about it.
What about the, talk about delusions. We can make this a theme for this part of the conversation. Yeah. So next point, what about the delusion that, but we're working on technology that will sequester the carbon? Because that's a growing belief as well, that there's people out there, they're working on these technologies and it'll somehow quickly absorb what we've done for the last few years. So it's okay because it'll make up for it.
Yeah. And the fossil fuel industry is very heavy into this. Scamming us on this. So there are technologies where you can inject that carbon back down into the ground where you took the oil out from. But it's there's so many problems with it. The IPCC has identified that in most cases it will leak back out again. You can't kind of contain it down there. But even if you could contain it down there, it takes so much energy to do that that it would basically take half of the energy that you get out of the fossil fuels. So it halves your net income from the fossil fuels, your net energy income, to stick it back down again. And this is where we run into this, and I don't know how good I am at explaining this, but the energy return on investment, the energy return on energy invested, not dollars invested, but energy. So we know that's in sharp decline already in fossil fuels, where all of the easy oil is gone. And so now we're into the hard stuff. And so the global average is somewhere around 14 at the moment. So one barrel of oil will get us 14 back again. You know, it's gone from, you know, sort of 30 in the 70s, 100 in the turn of the century, two centuries ago, when we turned into the 20th century. And so that has huge implications, because the energy that we have to put into getting the energy is going up. And so if we go, so it's down to 14. Well, if we have to sequester that carbon, then it goes down to 7. because you've taken half of the energy away, sticking it back under the ground again, and that's declining fast as well. And there's plenty of studies that show once you get below, you know, sort of two digits, once you get below 10, you're definitely in a situation where there's just no, there's no excess left over to run the kind of economies that we have at the moment. They're dependent on there being a really positive return on energy invested. And so that's where we, so we can do it on a very, very, and it has been done on a tiny scale. Like the last paper I saw, we've sequestered, the biggest sequestration, you know, plants in the world have sequestered about equivalent to about 3 minutes of our, of our yearly worth of years worth of emissions. So it's tiny, it's almost immeasurably tiny, okay. But massive amounts. I mean, if you see the pictures of these plants, obviously huge amounts of non-renewable materials gone into building these plants, you know, that nobody ever seems to think about.
Let alone the money.
Yeah, let alone the money.
Diverted to something more effective.
So speaking of the reduction in return of energy investment, talk about still being delusions, and this is going to become a segue into degrowth, renewable energy, because this is the other big, big thing right now that, you know, just switch over to renewable. Our corporate policy is to switch over to renewable energy, and that's going to help us achieve net zero.
There's
a big problem with that as well.
Oh, there's a huge problem with that. I mean, the thing to think about for a start is that it's the energy that's being captured is renewable, but the infrastructure and machinery that we use to catch it is rebuildable or replaceable energy. So, you know, wind turbines and solar panels, 20, 30 years if you're lucky, and then you have to completely replace them. So that's one of the delusions that needed to be pointed out. I've got the latest data from the IEA, the International Energy Agency, and these are just broad figures, but hopefully the listeners will understand the implications of it. So for offshore wind, it's about 10, and for solar it's about 7, and onshore wind is about 7. And those numbers, well, I'm going to explain, that's 7 to 10 times more material required per megawatt hour, per unit of energy. So I want people to think about the fact that we, and I don't know, Ben and Emma, I guess we need to go back to just reminding listeners that we have multiple crises. It's not just a climate crisis. We have multiple crises, which are all, so our oceans fished out, our biodiversity crashing, our massive, you know, increase in the number of the biomass of animals on the planet that is us and the animals we eat, you know, leaving about 3% of the biomass of animals on the planet that are wild animals, you know, the crash of insect populations and all that kind of stuff. So multiple, all symptoms of the same thing, which is overshoot. So you imagine, so you've got this planet that's teetering on the gone over these boundaries, but teetering on the collapse of life supporting capacity. And then somehow we think that we're going to replace all of that energy with these new systems that require 7 to 10 times more material to be dug up and processed and carted around the world to build these things. That's another utter delusion, you know. Just carrying on as we are would push us over the limits, let alone multiplying that by 7 to 10 times. And so that's where we get into this, you know, the amount of material. And I use copper as a good example to sort of explain the realities of that. We just had proposal. I don't know if you saw it, Emma, over there, but Ben, I'm sure you have the proposal for offshore wind turbines off Taranaki. There's a plan to put 54 of these offshore wind turbines. Just as an example, and just to take one metal that's involved in that, and that's copper. Each one, and this is figures from the IEA again, each one of those medium-sized offshore turbine will require 60 tons of copper, each one of them, to for the that connect it, to connect it all up to, you know, bringing it onshore and to the machinery that's involved in it. Just the copper, the rock to metal ratio. You can look it up online. Rock to metal ratio of every metal that we mine for all of these things. There's a ratio, and that means that's how much material has to be dug up. So for a ton of copper, you need to dig up 513 tons of material, put it on a truck, take it to the processing plant, spend all that energy processing it. You split the copper out the end of it, and a great big slag heap of rubbish to go back, you know, of material that you process to put back somewhere in a tailings dam, probably. But that 513 has been going up every year and will continue to go up. This is the crucial thing to understand, is that all of those materials that we're using, we've taken all the easy stuff with them, just like the oil. We've found all the easy copper, and now we get into the really hard stuff. So it's 513, you know, now. In another 10 years' time, it'll be 600 or 700, the rock to metal ratio. We'll have to process more and more material. This is where the two issues, and please, everybody, remember that all of this renewable is made from fossil fuels. And you know, so while I digress a bit, but it's something that really bugs me, is that I see all these headlines, you know, solar has never been so cheap. Renewable is so cheap that it's cheaper than fossil. Yeah, it's cheap because it's made from fossil fuels, and fossil fuels are stupidly cheap. We're not paying anywhere near what we should be, you know, for fossil fuels. So whenever you hear that, my immediate response is, and I do this on LinkedIn and online all the time, oh, great. So let's tell me the price of renewable made from renewable. Give me the price for a solar panel made from solar panels. And it would just be, and well, you just think the first generation of solar panels are made from fossil fuels. So it might look even doable for the first generation. But then when that's gone and you have to make the solar panels out of solar panels, you know, the energy from solar panels. Imagine having to all those trucks that are digging up that copper in South America and transporting it at 513, you know, rock to metal ratio, all being powered by solar. Then, you know, the price would be unbelievably high. And so, you know, that's the kind of reality we have to face. So you've got this multiplicative problem where the energy return on investment of the fossil fuels is going down, and the rock to metal ratio, or the you know, the ore concentration is going the other direction. So you have to dig up more material to get the same amount, and you have to mine, you have to get more fossil fuels to get the same amount of energy out of it. So those things work as a double kind of negative feedback to make the future look even more impossible. So it just means that it's going to be harder and harder and harder to get the materials, let alone the fact that, you know, a lot of these materials, there isn't enough of it to do what we want to do if we're thinking about, you know, matching what we have at the moment. And this is where the only answer for a sane person is degrowth, because if we try to match the current energy use with renewable, then we're gonna kill ourselves. It's suicidal to try and think that we could do that. And so then if you think about, and I guess this is a good time to introduce the fact that you know, the only advantage I can think of being an old dude like me is that I can look back, and I've actually got records. I've found the records on a database in New Zealand for per capita energy consumption, total energy consumption in New Zealand. I can hear all these people, that listeners going, oh, but we're 80% renewable in New Zealand. Well, no, we're not. Of our total energy consumption, it's 28% renewable in this country. And it hasn't changed since 1990. It's just cruised along at 28% renewable of our total energy use. But in my lifetime, our per capita energy has gone up almost three times. It's almost trebled in my lifetime. So all of that solar and wind that we've added in the last, or since 1990, where we have records, has not got us anywhere. We've just kept up with the growth in energy consumption. So we've done all of that harm. We've mined all those materials. We've built all those things. There's all those landscapes that have changed and all those roads and all those concrete foundations and everything to get us nowhere, to just keep up with our increased consumption. So that's why I'm not anti-renewables. I'm anti us kidding ourselves and adding all of this stuff and doing all this harm to just so we can have more junk and more toys in our lives and not. But the advantage I was trying to come back to with being old is that I know, and you can ask your granddad or your grandmother, you know, who was around in the 60s, was life terrible when you had a third less of the energy that we have today? And they will tell you that no, it was, you know, that all of the stuff that we kind of are convinced that we couldn't possibly live without hasn't improved our enjoyment of life, or any part of our life has not been improved by that extra energy. You know, I make jokes about it all the time. I mean, we used to wind up the windows in the car by hand, and we used to shut the back hatch. Not that we had hatches on our cars then, but didn't have a little motor to do it. I mean, all we've done is just added, and we used to scoot our own scooters with our feet rather than a motor in it, and we used to pedal our bikes without having a motor. You know, like all of the stuff that we keep adding to our lives, does it really make our lives better? Well, you know, I can tell you from my experience that it hasn't. It doesn't. And so if there's a positive, then, you know, I'm not big on positives. Everybody calls me Dr. Doom. But I can tell you just from my life experience and you know, and situations that I've lived in on very low energy, it's not the end of the world, you know. It's made to be scary, but it's not at all.
And there's another important layer to add onto this whole renewable energy concept. And our regular listeners will recall back last season, Associate Professor Dr. Simon, Professor Simon Michel, who explained, and using copper as an example, that, okay, so let's put it all aside. It's expensive, it's a ridiculous amount of mining, but let's do it anyway. Of the reported global reserves of copper in our earth, there is only, rounding the approximate figures, about 20% of what we need to transfer everything across. So that's already a problem in itself, is that we can't even transfer our whole energy system into renewable. Plus then the whole concept, and I remember this more clearly with say, if we went down a nuclear path, but the whole thing about how you discover mines, how long it takes to actually develop a mine into a working mine and all that. So it's, there's that extra layer as well, that even if we want to delude ourselves and think, nah, Mike's wrong, we can do this, we can get, but there's not enough of it. So that's also an important component.
And there's also the land area required. I mean, there's a great study, and I can, again, I can give you the links to this to share with listeners, but there's a, The author has actually died, unfortunately, in the meantime, but there was a great study that he did in the United Kingdom. Well, he did the whole world, but a whole bunch of countries. But just to really simplify it, if you take the energy consumption of any country and then calculate it by the land area, you get watts. So that's the flow of electricity per area of land, right? So he did it for the United Kingdom. And was 10 years ago, but that would not have changed much in that time. 1.25 watts per square meter was what, there's lots of watts going on here, but that's a flow of energy, right? You convert everything to electricity and then make it a flow, and it's 1.25 watts per square meter for the United Kingdom. He then did the big calculation of wind, solar, hydro, and biofuels. So the best of everything, mapped out the whole country, and he did it for a whole bunch of countries using GIS, so the difference in height, you know, so ignoring the fact that cities are there and all of that stuff, just assuming that you had the whole landscape to do what you wanted with it, the best mix of renewables, and what you came out with was 1.25 watts per meter squared. So for every square meter of land, the best you could produce from renewable energy for that latitude was 1.25 watts. So they match each other. In other words, you would need to cover the United, every square centimetre of United Kingdom would have to be covered in hydro, wind, biofuel or solar to be able to power the United Kingdom. And he you know, put it across, so for the United States, it would be half of the continental United States would be used up. So this is all your cropland, all of your, you know, the land that you would, you know, you'd be able to double up on some things, but Singapore, you would need 60 Singapores to power Singapore. That's the land area that you would need to be able to power it. So that's that kind of reality check, because that's what you would need to do that, because people will say, oh, but you could just, you know, you can grow all these biofuels. But no, we use, you know, we're using all the land that's available to feed ourselves at the moment, and we could certainly do better getting rid of a bunch of animals. But all of these things overlap in their requirements, you know, and plus then you're going to have to dig up half of this area to find these materials to do it as well. So all of these things, and you get this situation where people, you know, who are proponents of these things kind of, you know, put the shutters up, and they just look at their area of expertise and don't pull together all of these other realities, these competing land uses, you know, because there's other guys over here, they're going, oh, we're going to plant it all in trees because that's going to where we're going to offset all this carbon, you know. So all of these people in their little silos thinking that there's just this massive amount of land left to do all the things that we're going to magically do, without, you know, checking in with each other that, oh no, we want all that land to plant our trees. Oh no, we want that land because that's where we're going to put our solar panels. No, we're going to plant our biofuel crops there so we can keep flying jets around. You know, so there's just, and it's frustrating because, you know, these are good people mostly, and they believe in what, you know, their hearts are in the right places. They're just not stepping back and looking at the bigger picture. They're getting caught up in their little world of expertise, and it's a problem where we don't have this cross-disciplinary, you know, very few people that look across these things that see all of this and then realize how impossible it is.
So do you think it is just a lack of, you know, systems thinking within government to stop these policymakers from having a look at the actual facts and figures, and like we're just continuing to delude ourselves if we're not really addressing the logistics around this?
Well, no, we just saw what happened here with our recent elections. You talk, if you were to talk any of this stuff, you would be voted out by lunchtime tomorrow. You know, who gets voted in is the people that completely ignore this reality and just talk about cost of living, or, you know, let's make New Zealand great again, or some stupid thing like that. So, you know, so politicians can't, even if they understood it, they can't talk about this stuff because, you know, no one wants to hear it. And we have a, you know, a popularity voting system, or actually in our country, and it'd be great if you get someone on to talk about this, but you know, buying votes, about you know, seats per dollar spent on campaigning and that kind of thing. It's so blatantly clear that you know, the more money you have, the more. That's God, I wish they'd come over here and do one over here, because it's just prime for it. But I suspect that it's very similar in this country. You know, I think Australia and New Zealand are quite, you know, different electoral systems, but at the heart of it, it's pretty similar. Yeah.
Look at some of the changes already coming through. Seabed mining about to be approved, I think, in Taranaki as well, of all places.
And again, that'll be another classic of, yeah, we're going to seabed mine and we're going to build all these wind turbines. I don't think those two things go together. Well, I mean, in the freshwater space, they're going to chuck out the National Policy Statement. They're going to chuck out the Natural Built Environments Act. Well, this is what they're saying. I mean, I just don't think.
And bring back smoking.
You can make a whole. Yeah, we can fund all these tax cuts by you know, clearly just the idiocy of when you add in, and a few people have done this already, you know, the health costs of that would far outweigh, you know, any of those so-called, you know, returns that you'll get from that. And that's the same with so many of these environmental things. You know, not costing in those externalities of it, and just how much it will cost us in the long run, you know, whether it's short term kind of gain. There's just, as an aside, I was at a meeting, I got asked to talk at a meeting in the Wairarapa. There's plans for a big solar farm. So it looks like these international countries, and I think BlackRock's behind this as well, and we saw this happen with wind, is that you have a completely deregulated country that people that are a bit dim, New Zealand, and they haven't got regulations because they've never had big solar come along. So these big international companies go, oh, let's get in there now before they regulate this, and we can really make a killing on this stuff. And you know, so that's another big worry. I think there's plans for some big ones in Northland. They might even be underway, but they're big plans for the for massive ones in the Wairarapa as well.
And I think Waikato as well was one in the news a couple
of weeks
ago.
And so it's and when we talk about wind, you know, this plans for this offshore thing, there's currently consented, I can't remember, some incredible number of wind farms, you know, on land wind farms are already consented, but nobody's building them because there's just not the market for the electricity. At the moment, you know, we've got, as far as electricity goes, because we've got all of this other work being done by fossil fuels, there isn't a big market for, it's just not worthwhile building these turbines. The income you'll get from them is not worth it. And I suspect, and I can't prove it, but I suspect with these solar farms, what they're banking on is that they'll get paid through offset schemes from other countries. So other countries will be buying offsets, and so they'll be able to get money from offsets to build solar here, whether there's a market for the electricity or not. I mean, dumping a whole lot of electricity into the system in the middle of the day is where we don't have much use for it at that time. You know, it's those early morning and late afternoon peaks that we need it, and that's when the sun's low in the sky and we're just not getting that kind of thing. So it's really hard. I don't think you get any kind of sensible and plus the infrastructure that's just not there, the grids to handle it and all that kind of thing. So but we'll get silly stuff happening because it's a money-making venture for some big international company to come in and do it,
creating some jobs. That's a seller. Yep. Mm-hmm. Some corporates will look good because they'll align with it and say, hey, we're going to draw some power for this corporate from there. Tick. Great.
Yeah.
Get some accreditation with that going. Mm-hmm. It's all that bullshit that happens in that sort of not just governmental but corporate space as well. Anything that looks good, then let's just tick that box. Talking about where we're at the moment, and generally speaking, you know, there's still a lot of everywhere you go, everywhere you read, look, etc., talk of how we can still avoid hitting that 1.5 degree warming. Is that still a goal? Have we hit it? Are we beyond it? For our listeners, straight to the point, that 1.5 degree, which is the most common statement, where are we at with that?
No, people in the know have been laughing about that for a few years now, that we're way past that. But I think people can actually see now, you know, looking at average temperatures and all the graphs that pop up on your screen, that we're way above the 1.5. I mean, it will take, that 1.5 is based on an average for 5 years, I think. So it'll take 5 years before it's officially gone. But in the meantime, we can see that we're boosting above that already.
Yeah.
So that's another one of our delusions. Add that to the delusion list where we kid ourselves that, we can stay under this level when we can see that it's runaway, going past that at the moment.
And to add to that, globally this year was the first time ever where scientists could provide a detailed assessment on all the 9 planetary boundaries, and we're in the red for 6 of those 9.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, that research hardly made the mainstream news over here. I don't know if it was in New Zealand.
It didn't happen here either. No, it's that's really frustrating, and that's why you get the government we get, because this is I'm much more aware that as a science communicator, we failed, you know. I mean, we're doing our best, right? You guys have got this podcast going.
I mean,
we're trying.
You got a medal for communicating. Yeah. Why are you not getting through to the rest of this country?
Right. Yeah. I know. Well, kind of, what does it say? It says, if I win an award and I'm not getting anywhere, then what are the rest doing, kind of thing. So, I mean, we've been a bit facetious, but we can only go so far. If you know, the talkback radio and television aren't coming with us if they're all still playing silly games. And they are. They're funded by advertising. We have a system where we have a bit of money going into public broadcasting, but the bulk of it is just, you know, whoever's got the most advertisers. And so we're not going to get the truth when, I open up the morning, the post here, the printed paper, like I did this morning, and it's on the top of the page is Greymouth Petroleum. You know, it's every page of the paper is sponsored by a big oil company. And so climate gets talked about, but they won't, they'll only go so far. You know, it's like they'll talk about stuff that's happening overseas and they'll get caught up in ramping up talk about renewables here, but never mentioning those facts, you know, like that. That's a government, that's an MB report that I dug out, that stuff, that's 28% of our consumption is renewable and that hasn't changed since 1990. There's no stories in the media about that. Nobody's talking that.
Where
hard.
Did that 80% come from?
Oh, no, that,
believe
we,
it's 80%.
The 80% is true and sometimes it's up to 90%, but that's electricity, right?
Okay.
So yep. You know, remember that electricity is only a small part of our energy consumption. The real hard work is done by diesel and oil, you know, so all of the huge
and
big
coal?
Rigs. Yeah, coal. Yeah, drying our milk. Mm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, all of that, the big grunty energy stuff. The electricity does lighting and computers and heat pumps and things like that. But the heavy lifting is done by oil. And so, yeah, 72% of it is being done by oil.
I suppose if we're going to struggle to get governments to come to the party, if mainstream media is not on board, this is where groups like Degrowth Aotearoa become mm-hmm. so important. And you're the first member we've had on since your conference, so you'll have to
right,
tell us a
okay.
bit of a rundown
yeah.
on how that all went.
Mm. Yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, I think that everybody that went had was really inspired by it, especially the second day when everyone was talking about practical stuff. And I feel I'm on the edge. I'm the scientist talking about the inevitability of degrowth, I guess, that we will degrow, you know, whether we like it or not. And the choice, so then the choice is, do we do it in a managed, sensible way, or do we wait for the collapse, you know? And I like to use this analogy of, there's a big, we're all on a train, right? And we're roaring along this railway line and we're all sitting in different carriages. Some of us are in first class, some of us are in third class, and some are on the roof maybe, clinging onto the sides. You know, there's a lot of poor people that are really just hanging in. And we're heading for this, I don't know, the Mangaweka Viaduct, and it's collapsed, right? And we're running down the train going, we've got to stop the train. You've got to stop it because, that we're going to go off the cliff here. And there's a whole bunch of people, oh, no, we can't do that because if we jam the brake, and of course, every, just like the train roaring along the track, the longer we delay, the closer we get to that point and the harder the brake will have to be. So, you know, 30 years ago, the train was still in Wellington and you could have stopped it without anybody falling over. But the closer we get to where the viaducts collapse, the harder we're going to have to get hit the brakes to stop it going over the edge. And we've got all these people saying, oh, no, you can't do that because, you know, well, for a start, my wine glass on the table here is going to tip over and smash and I won't have my wine. And then the other people are going, well, you know, and then all these people that aren't restrained in their seats are going to crash against the, you know, the seat in front of them and they're going to be hurt in the process, you know. And it's like, well, yeah, but if we don't, what's going to happen? We're going to go over the cliff and we're all dead, you know. So there's not like there's some other option here. And so that's the kind of, because that's the argument you hear all the time, or, oh no, you degrowthers, what will happen to all these poor people? They won't have food and they won't have this and they won't have that. Well then, yeah, but if we don't do, you know, there is inequity is a huge part of this, but if we don't do it, there's no magic savior here. We have to stop.
First question from our listeners, mm-hmm. since we're talking about degrowth, and I'm not quite sure of the background of it, but I suspect where it's coming from. The question is, it's from Brad, your thoughts on changing degrowth to beyond growth?
Well, I mean, I think that we're pretty clear that we degrow to a point where we just have a stable, you know, and then, you know, that's beyond growth. We don't grow, we don't get bigger, we don't get smaller. We just find this place where we can be sustainable. It's not like it has to keep going down and down and down forever. It goes down and then it flattens. But the semantics of wording are kind of frustrating because, you know, degrowth's a bad word because it has negative connotations or whatever. I don't know. It's, you know, it's in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? It has different meanings to different people.
To me, the word brings more urgency because it's like you said, the train is not still in the station in Wellington that, let's jazz up the word and make it pretty. It's freaking urgent. And if we don't act we're off this precipice. So it kind of brings that urgency. But at the same time, it's understanding what degrowth actually means. And there is that perception that degrowth does have that negative connotation because you're already starting with a negative word, degrowth.
Yeah.
But the reality is, and you touched on an important component, and we had a conversation on this earlier in the season about inequalities. And that actually it does address it. This is part of the whole point. It's not just stopping where we are. The rich stay rich, the poor stay poor. It's also addressing that whole balance. There's a whole lot to it.
And I don't know if I talked about this before, but I quickly found that I did the sums and half of New Zealanders, and I don't know the numbers for Aussie, I could probably find it, but half of New Zealanders, the upper half of, so split in the middle of income in New Zealand, half of New Zealanders are in the top 10% globally of wealth, responsible for, you know, more than half of the greenhouse gas emissions and consumption. 10% of New Zealanders are in the top 1% globally. So we're a wealthy country, and people, I think there's this tendency to go, oh, it's the 1%. You know, I see a lot of the stuff about, you know, private jets and all that kind of thing. I'm not saying that's not true or anything like that, but I do think we need to look around and realize that we are in that group. You know, it's not some rich people somewhere else. It's us. I suspect a lot of your listeners will be in that 50%, you know, who are the 10%.
Well, look at our
global
days.
10%. Yeah.
Overshoot days. For New Zealand's what? April? And
April 19th. Yeah, where was Aussie? Was it before or after that?
They march.
A little bit before.
Yeah, but before, yeah. I know, we're in it. The two of us are in amongst the... We're in the bad... Well, you know, we're in the bad lot. And I can't remember if I've talked about it before, but it was a kind of a weird realization for myself that, you know, looking at renewable energy or the energy options for the future. And I thought one day I asked myself the question. So, okay, say tomorrow, this magic that people talk about, whether it's, you know, nuclear fission or, you know, some magic energy source turned up tomorrow that had no implications whatsoever environmentally. You know, it had no carbon involved in it, and we had cheap or free energy forever. Would that be a good thing? And when I asked myself that and looked around, I realized no. Because what's enabled us to push, to fish out the oceans, to chop down all the trees, to have all those animals, all of the things that we're talking about, all of those planetary boundaries have come about because of the availability of cheap energy, you know? So no, the only hope for us is we run out of energy to carry on with this crazy lifestyle. It's like, you know, thinking about the teenager with just borrowed the credit card or something like that. The only thing that's going to stop them going crazy and partying and wrecking the place is when they run out of energy, is when they run out of money. Well, for us, it's energy. So that's quite a sobering thing to think about it because we kind of concentrate so much on it.
We're very lucky in these two countries, and we really should be stepping up to the plate and taking more responsibility, because look at our neighbours, like all the small island developing states, they're getting smashed by extreme climate events, and like they don't have the finances behind them to deal with that, and we're causing the problem.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at some of those places, they're in trouble because, well, I keep thinking of Nauru because we exploited the hell out of that to boost, you know, farming in this country, and so we've sort of profited. We're rich. We're in that rich place because we exploited these other places that are in trouble now. So we really have to, you know, start facing up to some of those realities.
Yep. And like even to take that to the extreme end of things, the Marshall Islands, where all the nuclear testing was done by the US, like that's now leaking because of sea level rise, and the US aren't really helping them come to the party and fix that. Like,
no,
it's just,
and a lot of
unethical.
Yeah, you could chase that wealth of the US back to having that nuclear threat to be able to do what they've done. So, you know, those weapons developed at the cost of those other people.
All right. So before we get into the rest of the questions, just quickly pivoting, fresh water in New Zealand. Can you provide us a bit of an update on the state of play regarding fresh water and the nitrate levels? I see Greenpeace recently launched the Know Your Nitrate map, and there seems to be a fair few red areas.
No, that's the reality is that no, it's not getting any better at all. And we just had another report fresh out today. I had a copy, embargoed copy, until 5 a.m. this morning. I don't know why 5 a.m. on a Thursday morning is the embargo time. But, so this is just a study where they looked at the current limits that we have under the National Policy Statement and how much change would you need to have to be able to meet those limits, basically. So we've got a whole bunch of national bottom lines for some things that we measure in fresh water. I've talked about it before, and I could go on again about it all night, but we have this completely fake limit based on nitrate toxicity. But even to meet this fake limit, which is 5 or 10 times higher than what it should be, the level of change required is massive, and that's what this report looked at. And for example, my favourite lake, Ellesmere, Te Waihoro in Canterbury, the amount of nitrate going in there at the moment was 3,690 tons. And to meet the national bottom line, the maximum that should be allowed to go into that lake was 290 something. So that's, you know, we're not just, this is the thing where people think, oh, well, you know, we just cut back by 10 or 20% and we'll be right. You know, it's, you know, and that our big study that we've talked about before, where we looked at the footprint of making milk in Canterbury, and we're showing that you need like a 95% reduction in the amount of nitrate going into fresh water to have a hope of having, you know, healthy and drinkable fresh water in the future. So that was, it's kind of buried in, you know, the fact that you write a report to say that if we meet the national policy statement, we're going to have to make all this change. It actually just feeds into this government going, well, the obvious answer is we get rid of the national policy statement because clearly it's going to mean, you know, farming's going to have to be reduced. So it's almost, we're in this limbo now of we don't want to give them any more ammunition because they'll just cut even more of this legislation. You know, maybe we're better just keeping quiet about it in the meantime. And that's where it's right at the time when we needed to put the brakes on, and more science is coming in to show that at exactly the same time they're going to throw it out according to their plans.
Okay.
So here's a question from Sam. How do you stay positive in the face of this climate catastrophe? And let's just change the word to climate, or actually just put a strike through it, catastrophe.
Yeah, effectively. No, that's for sure. Yeah. I get asked this a lot. I don't know.
You're still smiling. We're still cracking jokes. I mean.
Yeah. I know. But, it's actually really bizarre because my, fresh water used to be the thing that got me so head up, and that was, you know, driving me so batty trying to do something about fresh water and, you know, the way we've trashed fresh water. But it kind of, in a way, this is really bizarre, but the rest of the crises have put fresh water into, you know, it's not quite so bad because we have all this other stuff.
Hey, we still have water, right?
Yeah. So it's like, mean, it's bizarre, but that's kind of the strange place. But look, the only way I get through it, and I suspect it's the same for you guys, because this podcast is your action. Like, this is our way of doing something, and as long as you're doing something, then you can say positive, because you're creating hope by trying to get the word out there to try and get that change to happen. And so that's what I say to young people, you know, who just get, you know, completely kind of flummoxed by how bad everything is. But then once you start doing something, even if it's small, you can then handle it because you're doing something about it. The worst thing is just to sit back and go, oh, I can't do anything about this. It's all too bad, and do nothing. And then you'll get buried by it then. But if you start doing something, you create hope doing that, and you can survive. Is it? I suspect it's the same for you guys.
Grounded hope. We've spoken about this for years now, and actually we had a wonderful conversation with a recent guest, a UK ultra marathon runner, and he calls himself a hypocritical environmentalist.
Yes.
And the whole notion around that is, don't let the notion of being imperfect stop you from doing anything, you know, because sometimes it's, well, what's the point of doing this if I'm not going to do that? You know, I'll stop driving, but I'm still flying. So what's the point of stopping driving? No, stopping driving is still a positive action, and you might still need to fly. I mean, these are, you know, sort of extreme examples.
No, that's so true,
But, you know, that's so powerful because no one is going to be perfect, and none of us are. But, you know, we all take action in very different ways and some very meaningful ways. So, yeah, I think that's important is that the little, it's exactly what you said, and it's exactly what we always say, the collective amounts to a lot. It's very frustrating. You know, we look at government policy at the moment, and it's really frustrating seeing how much it's going backwards to, in some cases, trying to be leading with, like, banning smoking to now regressing that. I see a lot what's happening in the corporate world, and I just bang my head every single day. It's sort of, do you want change, or do you want to pretend you're making change as a corporate? And then, of course, what you see around us every day, walking down the street and just looking at general population behavior, and it's easy to lose yourself. So couldn't agree more.
Well, I think that Greta Thunberg, she nails all of this stuff so well, but you know, I think I've said it before that, you know, about hope, you know, people need hope, right? So I say, okay, so hope that you'll get lunch tomorrow and see how you get on, you know. It's not something you can just grab. You create hope by doing something to be able to get, you know, grow some food to have your lunch tomorrow. And then you've given hope. It's not a noun, it's a verb, hope. And you make hope.
All right. Flowing on from that then, this question's from Tamara. What can I do as an individual that will make the most impact in the short term and the long term?
Well, it depends where you're starting from, but in most cases it's diet. So getting, you know, as much as possible, removing meat from your diet, especially, you know, beef and ruminant meat. And, you know, in most cases, but if you're already there, then you have to move on to something else. You know, it's so there's no kind of one answer, but in many cases, diet is a really good place to start. And then think about all of the other things in your life that consume, you know.
Yeah. I'm going to ask a controversial question because I've put this out there, and maybe my words could have been, you know, chosen a little bit more carefully. But the question is, are you an environmentalist if you eat meat? I mean, it's flipping it around. You know, it's a very generic question, and it's very direct, and it can piss a lot of people off. Yeah. And, you know, now I thought, well, maybe it should be reducing or sort of prettying it up. But am I contradicting myself with the whole being imperfect as well? But the food system is a big contributing factor, isn't it? I mean, that's the reality.
Well, I would say, are you an environmentalist if you're pro-renewable energy? You know, are you an environment? The environment movement in New Zealand started with people opposing dams, you know. So you need to be aware. It keeps coming back. It's like, you know, young people I know who are vegans and they become vegans because they're really worried about a whole lot of environmental and ethical reasons around animals. But then they don't apply the same level of, you know, of curiosity to where that product is that they're buying instead of the meat, you know. And so if you do that, then great. But, you know, we need to – I don't want to tell anybody how to live. You know, I'm not in that space. I'm a hypocrite and I admit it. I don't eat animals. But I tell you what I've thought about recently, and I thought of many examples of this, but I would if someone goes and kills an animal and eats it, then, you know, good on them. But the people who go to the supermarket and get meat, I mean, I want them to go to the abattoir, and I want them to go to the killing room at the abattoir, and or the place where they kill the chooks or whatever, and spend a couple of hours there, and then see if you still want to eat meat after that. And you know, go around New Zealand to some mines. Go and ask to visit, and you know you're going to get the greenwashing from the mining company. But go see tailings dams and learn about how the impacts of that. If you're gonna, you know, there's so many of these things where we are so disassociated from the harm that goes with our choices that I feel that's really part of why we delude ourselves, because we never have to face seeing that reality. You know, it's maybe if every kindergarten or school had to go to an abattoir, you know, sort of a field trip to an abattoir killing room, then we would really change some of the behavior that we have, because we just become so disconnected from the harm that we do.
And then follow that up with some therapy sessions.
Yeah, well, no, it would be really, yeah, no, because you wouldn't do it after that. So they wouldn't be around for the next generation to have to go and see, because nobody would want it. I mean, you know, it's not, some people can handle that and they're okay.
Out of sight, out of mind. That's the usual story.
Yeah, that's the issue, isn't it? Yeah, and that goes for renewable as well, you know. We get the nice shiny solar panel, or we get the nice Tesla or the battery car. We don't have to see the harm that goes with it. And so we can disassociate ourselves from all of that stuff.
So, question from Alan: what needs to change to promote better education and awareness on climate concerns? Listen to this podcast. I mean,
Well,
you know, for teachers, educators and so on, I mean, how do we promote it better?
Well, I think we've got to follow the money. And clearly, if we follow the money with you two, you're not in it for the profit. You're not doing this for
follow the money, you'll end up in our back pockets.
I know, exactly. You're funding it. So you've got to think about, you know, if you're getting your information from, you know, MediaWorks or any of these big, you know, companies, you know, that, like, you know, I know that they signed deals with Fonterra, you know, they got, it's just so, it's so corrupt, and people are getting what they pay for, or they don't pay for. That's, if you don't pay for it, and this is, or, you know, in your case, you're doing it out of the goodness of your hearts or your beliefs. But, you know, most of that media people need to be thinking about who's profiting from this. Where's the money coming from? Why am I seeing this? Who's paying for it? And if they would, you know, apply that kind of critique to it, you might start to think about why you're seeing this particular view of the world. It might make more sense if we could, you know, see through the product placement and the advertising dollars that have gone into it.
Another follow-on question that goes nicely after that is from Jenny. How important are my actions as an individual when businesses and governments aren't doing their fair share?
Yeah, I know, but I see lots of the stuff, you know, the oil companies are the problem, and they just want you to be, you know, seeing, you know, your carbon footprint and all that. It's got to be both. I mean, the oil companies wouldn't exist if we didn't buy their oil, you know, if we didn't use all the products that come from that oil. So you can't distance yourself from it and say, oh, it's just these 70 companies, when these 70 companies exist because people buy their products. So it has to be both ways. We can't just cut ourselves off from it. But I do see the future, and this is very much part of degrowth, is that the only way we will survive in the future is as communities, again, as small communities, you know, supporting each other and all of the kind of unpaid things that are so important to our lives, but don't count in the economics textbooks as the future. And so, you know, that individualism is non-existent. We can't survive as individuals. We need communities to survive. And so that and you know, the pointlessness of blaming corporations while we keep buying their products is also part of it as well.
Yeah. Emma, did you send Mike the questions? Because he's segueing so well from one question to the next. Because the next one here from Natalie is, how can communities best come together to drive positive change in action? I mean, that's a big component of degrowth, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I see bits of it in my life because I live in Pakakariki, which is, I don't know, there's 1,000-odd houses here. And so many community, positive community things. And that's what the second day of the Degrowth Aotearoa conference was really just what the theme that ran through all of these positive things that are happening is that they're small scale, you know, people doing things not for money, but because they can see the positives and you do something for me and I do something for you. And, you know, we get back to that kind of supportive, you know, like it happens in households, you know, all of the things that are important aren't paid for, you know, it's all of the things that matter to us as humans are not, don't have money involved in them, but somehow, you know, we get caught up in this thing. And another little thing that's been happening to me very recently is I think it came up at the conference actually, this idea of capitalism as a cult. And, you know, we're all in this cult of the cult of capitalism, and we're like people that are caught up in a cult. And I've been looking, there is, you know, psychological assessments and processes and programs you can go through to kind of get yourself out of a cult. I think potentially we all need to go through, you know, because all we've ever known is this cult, you know, that it's so much part of our lives and our parents and our grandparents, and all we've known is this world of living in this cult. And even though it's so incredibly harmful, like most cults are, you know, they have terrible impacts for the people that are caught up in them. Maybe one day you could get somebody, a psychologist, on to talk about how you get people out of cults, and we could start thinking about ways of, you know, a 12-step program or something to de-cult us out of capitalism, because it's, you can so clearly see that it's just, it's leading us in the wrong direction.
There's that community outreach.
Kool-Aid.
There's that community outreach program we want to do, Emma. There we go. Capitalist. So, Mike, to start wrapping up, let's look ahead now, 2024. It's lots of problems, 99 problems. And where do we start in 94? I mean, there's the ongoing and increasing amount of greenwashing around us, empty promises, again, delusions. You know, everything you buy is offset. You're planting a tree. Come with us, sign up with us. We're signed up to this program that's environmentally better. All this bullshit around us constantly every day in the mail outs and marketing on shopfront windows and in corporate manuals and et cetera, et cetera. Navigating through that, what are some of the sort of tangible actions that we should start taking, or not start, maybe be doing better? We're already doing them, but doing them better going into the new year. What are some of the important things we should be focusing on? That 1.5 degree, it's there. So let's stop talking about that. It's going to get worse. We need to accelerate our action. We're talking a lot. What should we be doing?
It's a tough one, but I think that where you can see for your own eyes the chain, so buying food that's grown locally or by your friends or in your own garden and buying stuff that's made by somebody you know, and you know, so cut out the bullshit by trying to make everything in your life free of those kind of organizations that are involved in that stuff. And I know there's a limit to what you can do, and you know, I'm lucky, you know, some of us are lucky enough to have a house with a garden and we can do lots of these things, and I know it's not the same for lots of people, but I think just trying to, wherever possible, to support local, to buy local, not get caught up in the, you know, Amazon, whatever, you know, online buying and all that kind of stuff. you know, try to avoid anything that involves that those huge chains of you know, globalization is probably a really good start. And you know, we should, in many cases we can do it with food, and it might mean a bit more work, but supporting, you know, local composting and you know, local, you know, places, repair shops, all of those kind of things that came up at the degrowth, you know, website has lots of these options. So I really you know, suggest that people go to the DANZ New Zealand Degrowth Aotearoa New Zealand website, and there is so much information on how you can kind of bypass a lot of this rubbish.
So know the source of your product, yep. Whether it be clothing, yep. Or you know, appliances gets pretty hard because everything's made in one place over the world. But yep. But with yep. a lot of yep. the sort of more tangible things, clothing, food, and you know, all that kind of stuff. Look, for New Zealand, new government coming in place, this can be quite depressing. Seeing a lot of things being reversed, it's frustrating in Australia. Seeing, you know, as I said at the beginning, lack of action. But communities, we don't need government policies or corporates to sponsor things. We can still enable change. So there's so many ways you can actually take action. Mm-hmm. We don't need corporate policies. So for our listeners, just if you just look back, just this year's plethora of guests that we've had, there's so much inspiration there. So there's a lot we can be doing, but we need to be doing it. Stop thinking about it and actually start doing.
That's it. I'd echo your words there. So stop concentrating on stuff. Start concentrating on people and actually do something. So like find your people, find your community, because without a movement, there's no stopping ecological breakdown. So we need to be finding our people, doing something, getting that movement going.
Yeah. All the best changes that have ever happened in our history have been from the ground up. They don't come, government's not going to do it. Forget it. It's going to come from the ground up. We have to be the change, and we live the change and make it happen. And we have the power if enough of us start doing it. So,
Dr. Mike Joy, as always, thank you so much for giving up your precious time. We really appreciate always, every single time, having you on the show and sharing your insights. There's a reason why you win these awards for communicating, because you communicated so well, and our listeners certainly appreciate that. And these are the kind of episodes, maybe the numbers are high because they listen to it three times. You know, take notes and really let it sink in. So, you know, a great way to end off this season, this year. Thank you so much again for your words of wisdom and bringing that little bit of extra hope that we all need.
Great. Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.